Hello and welcome to this Microsoft TechNet session on Exchange 2007. My name is Robin McManus. Let's start the session by going into more detail on exactly what we will be covering. During this session, we will be discussing storage for Exchange Server 2007. We'll start with an overview of storage and discuss the Exchange Server 2007 design goals related to storage. We will compare and contrast Exchange 2003 and Exchange 2007 storage architectures and outline the benefits to system administrators of the 2007 approach. We'll take a look at reliability and high availability using single copy clustering, SCC, and both local continuous replication and continuous clustered replication. We will outline the five server roles that have been introduced since 2007. And discuss how each role uses storage. We will also be covering the issues that affect storage design for each of these server roles. Then we will move on to a section about the critical area of backup and recovery in 2007. Before finishing today's session with a discussion on monitoring and testing storage, followed by a short demonstration on stress testing. As with most TechNet sessions, some prior experience of Microsoft technologies or similar technologies is always helpful. Here's a brief overview of what will be helpful, but not essential, for this session. As we go through today's session, you will hear various Microsoft acronyms and terminology. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or from other versions of Microsoft products that we may not spend time on. To help you out, we have listed the areas that it may be helpful to be familiar with, either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. It would be helpful to have some IT administration experience with Microsoft Exchange Server 2003, Exchange 2000 Server, or Exchange Server 5.5. To cover the topics mentioned and keep the session flow going, we have divided the session up into the following agenda items. We have broken today's session into five topics. As we complete each topic, we'll return to this agenda. We're going to start today's session with an outline on the major features of Exchange Server 2007 storage architecture and the benefits they provide to administrators. We'll discuss reliability improvements, backup, and regulatory conformance. We'll start with a look at why the product group decided that the new version of Exchange Server should be built on a 64-bit messaging platform. Some of you may be wondering why Exchange Server 2007 requires 64-bit hardware and a 64-bit operating system. Well, the developers in the product group decided that the 32-bit platform was beginning to restrict what could be done with Exchange, especially as it pertains to capacity and performance. Most of us are buying 64-bit hardware today, but we're still using 32-bit applications. To a large extent, that's probably because there are few 64-bit applications available. But whatever the reason, by doing so, we constrain our hardware. We're not able to utilize the 64-bit platform properly. If you think about servers that we installed several years ago, maybe with as much as 4 gigabytes of memory, well, they're now expected to support more users and probably with bigger mailboxes. So as older servers are struggling with the new demands for storage, reliability, and security. By shifting to a 64-bit operating system and application, Exchange has better stability and more room for maneuvering. More memory means that we can support more users and mailboxes. It also means we can allocate more memory to cache. The larger cache size is possible with a 64-bit platform will also boost performance. Effectively, the database cache size is limited only to the amount of physical memory available. To try to determine a suitable physical memory for a server, aim for 2 gigabytes plus 5 megabytes per user mailbox. And remember, adding memory increases the cache, which reduces database read operations, which reduces I.O. The cost and complexity of storage is a major reason to switch to Exchange 2007. Many Microsoft customers have Exchange servers with large disks, but they're only using a small fraction of that capacity. This is because the server can't support the number of users or the size of mailbox that would consume the available space. In effect, the disk space is going to waste. And disks can't go much faster. That spindle can only spin so fast. There needs to be a way to allow Exchange to perform well enough so that it can handle more users, use that wasted space, and not bottleneck at any physical disk. By adding more memory and growing the cache, it reduces the I.O. per disk, allowing each disk to support more users faster. This means the wasted space is reduced and the server runs quicker. The difference between taking cache from 200 megabytes to, say, 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabyte, or 4 gigabytes reduces the I/O throughput requirement on a system by more than 70%. What that means is that you can support more and larger mailboxes. But the benefit of a 64-bit really depends on how your disks are configured for exchange. For many of you, you will need 1/4 of the disks, or you can put 4 times as many users on the same number of disks, or you can give users 4 times the disk space for their mailboxes, whatever suits you best. When you consider that most of the capital investment in exchange servers is on storage, it makes sense to utilize the existing servers and storage by switching to Exchange 2007, rather than replacing the server hardware and storage. Email is a mission-critical application. It's essential for administrators to achieve the highest possible level of availability, reliability, and recoverability within the constraints imposed by the available budget. Exchange 2007 introduces several features that you can use to improve these areas. These include local continuous replication, LCR, and clustered continuous replication, CCR, plus improvements in the backup architecture. We'll be discussing these new features later in today's session. But briefly, in LCR, the computer running Exchange maintains a duplicate of a storage group on another volume in the server. In CCR, another physical server maintains a copy of the storage group. A process called log shipping synchronizes the storage group copies. So using a 64-bit messaging platform brings notable benefits in terms of cost reduction, simplicity, more efficient use of available storage, flexible storage options, and higher availability. Let's compare the throughput of Exchange 2007 against Exchange 2003. If we look at Exchange 2003 server and a similarly specified Exchange 2007 server, both production systems under similar loads, we can see quite a difference in disk I/O. The additional cache available under 2007 means approximately a 70% reduction in database I/O compared with the 2003 server. Remember, these are two production systems with similar load characteristics. The number of IOs per second, IOPS, in each user is around 1 under Exchange 2003, but only 0.27 under Exchange 2007. Similarly, the number of read operations per user drops from 0.6 to only 0.08, while even write operations are reduced from 0.41 to 0.2. These are significant differences. So from a disk I/O load perspective, the move to a 64-bit is a beneficial one. Previous versions of Exchange Server ran on 32-bit operating systems. Computers that run on 32-bit operating systems are usually limited to 4 gigabytes of addressable memory. This memory limitation can lead to poor performance on servers that support many mailboxes. Production versions of Exchange Server 2007 run on 64-bit versions of Microsoft Windows Server 2003. Computers that run 64-bit operating systems can access large amounts of physical memory. This memory allows for the support of large numbers of mailboxes and significantly improves server throughput. Large, low-cost mailboxes are made possible because increases in addressable memory mean more memory can be allocated to storage cache, which reduces the I/O on physical disks. Making mailboxes larger introduces problems. However, to enable you to implement larger mailboxes without degrading performance, content indexing has now been improved to ensure users can find what they're looking for when they've searched their mailboxes. We touched on LCR and CCR, but a side benefit to these fault-tolerant services is that administrators can perform backups from replica storage group. This doesn't affect users connected to the production copy of the storage group. Legal obligations, regulatory conformance, and business process requirements force many organizations to use policies to filter, edit, and store email messages that pass through their organization. Whether the communication is internal or external, maintaining these policies can be complex and time-consuming. Exchange Server 2007 provides features to make these processes streamlined and efficient. These features require little administrative effort or user intervention. The Email Lifecycle, ELC, focuses on email retention policies that define how long Exchange Server must archive a message, how and where the message must be stored, and when Exchange Server must delete the message. Exchange Server 2007 makes a number of improvements in the storage database to aid recovery, such as simple database naming. The mailbox store name is no longer server dependent, which means you can restore a mailbox store to any server in the organization. And because of auto-discover, the client computers will be redirected automatically to the new location of the store. Simplified database structure. The requirement for separate streaming content file .stm for the mailbox and public stores has been removed. This change makes it easier for you to perform database restore operation because the database structure is simpler. Increased number of log files. In Exchange Server 2003, the transaction log file names had only 5 characters to indicate the sequence of the log file. For example, e01001.log. Exchange Server 2007 increased the number of log files associated with the storage group to a factor of 2000 by allowing 8 characters. Log files provide the primary mechanism for data replay for a storage group. In addition, in the event of a problem resulting in data loss, Exchange Server provides fast recovery through the Volume Shadow Copy service in both LCR and CCR. Let's look at LCR and CCR in more detail. Exchange Server 2007 now supports log shipping as a way of providing an up-to-the-moment backup of a storage group to guard against storage group and database failures. As you are probably aware, transaction log files are used in Exchange Server to hold changes that are about to be made to the database in a given storage group. These logs contain a record of all changes made to the database since the last normal backup. If you take a copy of a storage group, all that's needed to synchronize the database it contains with a live system is to replay the log files against the copy. That is the basis of both LCR and CCR. As you are also probably aware, performing a restore operation is a time-consuming process. If we can reduce the situations where we would need to perform them, that's got to be a good thing. The Exchange product group looked at the information about when and why restores were being done. And they discovered that the most common reason for performing a restore was disk drive failure. All bearings in a disk drive wear out every couple of years, and people have to look to backup to recover. Log shipping is a great way to get around that because it's a continuous replication. Each log file is played back against the duplicate storage group's database, so you always have a live copy of the database available in case the disk drive fails. In some ways, LCR is like a locally stored mirror of the database. However, there are situations where other failures can cause the database to become unavailable. If your server power supply goes out, having a local copy of the database won't help. CCR was designed for 2 computers to support a complete server failure and, therefore, address this problem. You can create a copy of the database on another computer, and log shipping keeps them synchronized. It's been designed so that those servers can also be in 2 different physical sites, geographically separate if you want, to have insurance against site failure. And this is all built into Exchange 2007. A side benefit of having multiple copies of a database at all times is that when you do perform backup operations, you can do it on a standby database. This will reduce the performance impact on your users, and although LCR and CCR reduces the likelihood of having to resort to a restore operation after this failure, they also reduce the number of backups that you need to perform. Of course, having a second copy of a database doesn't protect you from accidentally deleting something, since deletion will be duplicated on the replica. The other major reason for performing a restore is when users have deleted information. The dumpster interval was 3 days in Exchange 2003. That's been increased to 14 days in Exchange 2007. This should allow users to recover the information without you needing to restore the whole database and then merge mailboxes across. Next, we'll review each of these technologies. By reducing the number of backup operations, the cost of performing backups and maintaining archives is reduced. Administrators are always looking for ways to reduce costs, and LCR can perform a reduction in the total cost of ownership of Exchange. Although you cannot guard against all forms of data loss, with LCR you can protect against the most common. Loss of a storage group through loss of the underlying disk, and you won't even need to perform a restore. Backups do not provide fault tolerance. They provide a means to recover lost data. A system that can continue to operate after a failure of a component is said to be fault tolerant. With LCR, your server will continue to operate even if your disk fails, provided you have everything in place. Log files and the correct disk configurations have always given you the ability to recover to the point of failure, and now With lock shipping, you can achieve a higher level of resilience. Simply stated, you need to perform far fewer backups. Previously, when a disk failed, you would need to replace it, perform the restore of a storage group, and then to replay the logs since the last backup. Now you don't need to do anything, at least not immediately. The system is still running. Let's summarize the benefits of CCR and see how it takes reliability and recovery to the next level. CCR has all the benefits that LCR does, but provides few more. Because Exchange Server 2007 only supports active, passive cluster configurations, there is no single point of failure. This makes the cluster more fault-tolerant. The more reliable your messaging system, the easier things will be for you. You don't have to install the cluster on shared storage devices. Because of this, CCR supports a wider range of storage. You don't have to install on a shared storage, which means the requirements for the server hardware are less stringent. Nor do you have to select the hardware from the cluster category in the Windows Server Catalog. As long as the servers in the cluster are comparable, that's all you need to worry about. With Exchange Server 2007, you can create a cluster that spans multiple data centers. Without the need for third-party software, everything you need is built into Exchange. The Exchange product group has unified the cluster installation process with the standard mailbox server role installation, so no specialized knowledge is required to install CCR. It's quick and easy to set up. And all cluster-specific related management tasks are hidden underneath the associated generic Exchange Server Management task. For example, when you perform storage group reconfiguration, Exchange Server performs the related CCR management tasks for you. Because CCR creates a second copy of databases on a passive node, the passive node can be used to offload the effect of doing regular backups. For example, by doing backups on the passive node, the backup window can be extended and the I/O load is no longer on the active node. A quick word about single copy clustering. Single copy clusters, SCC, provide another clustered solution. However, SCC uses a single copy in a storage group on storage that is shared between the nodes in the cluster. SCC is similar to clustering in previous versions of Exchange Server, with some significant changes and improvement. Both LCR and CCR rely on duplicate copies of the storage group and do not share hardware. Single copy Exchange clusters require the use of a shared nothing architecture. In this architecture, although all nodes in the cluster can access shared data, they cannot access it at the same time. For example, if a physical disk resource is assigned to node 1 of a two-node cluster, node 2 cannot access the disk resource until node 1 is taken offline, fails, or the disk resource is moved to node 2 manually. Windows communicates with resources in a cluster by using a resource DLL. Exchange 2007 provides its own custom resource DLL to communicate with the cluster service. Communication between the cluster service and Exchange 2007 is customized to provide Windows cluster functionality. Exchange 2007 uses window cluster groups to contain Exchange virtual servers in a cluster. A clustered mailbox server is a Windows cluster group containing cluster resources, such as an IP address, one or more physical disk resources, the Exchange system attendant resource, and other Exchange resources. Clustered mailbox servers include Windows cluster service resources, such as IP address resources, network name resources, and physical disk resources. Clustered mailbox servers also include their own Exchange-specific resources. When creating a clustered mailbox server, Exchange automatically creates the other essential Exchange-related resources, such as an HTTP virtual server instance and an information store instance. Perhaps the significant thing to remember when planning to use SCC is that the nodes must share storage. This is not a requirement of either LCR or CCR. In addition, the server computers themselves must meet more stringent requirements. For Exchange 2007, cluster nodes running on Windows Server 2003, Enterprise or Data Center editions, you must select from the hardware listed in the Windows Server Catalog under the Cluster Solutions category. This is not necessary for implementing either LCR or CCR. By way of comparison, in Exchange 2003, you need to take daily backups and, when required, restore them to identically rebuilt server. Exchange Server 2007 allows you to perform restores of storage groups to any server, regardless of detailed configuration. In addition, you no longer need to perform daily normal backups, but you can rely on a combination of weekly normal and incremental backups. In Exchange 2003, users had only 3 days in which to recover their deleted items. Now they have 14 days. And if you're beyond the 14-day window, you can still restore to any server. The last 2 points make the most significant impact. When a disk failed in Exchange 2003, you needed to restore to an identically rebuilt server. In Exchange 2007, you don't need to do anything. Continuous replication means the server is still running. If you faced a site-wide disaster with Exchange 2003, again, it's restored to an identically rebuilt server. With CCR in Exchange 2007, you don't need to do anything, as CCR can run across multiple sites without the need for any third-party software or components. Let's return to the agenda. In the second section, we'll be talking about the implications for storage when considering specific Exchange server roles. We'll start with a summary about the 5 server roles before moving on to look at each role in detail. Exchange Server 2007 server roles fall into 1 or 2 broad categories. One role is designed to be deployed in the perimeter network outside the corporate intranet with no access to Active Directory, and all the other roles are designed to be installed inside the intranet with access to Active Directory. The server in the perimeter network, called the Edge Transport Server, is isolated from Active Directory and functions as a message hygiene and routing engine. It's responsible for filtering messages as they arrive from untrusted networks, like the internet. Although it's not part of your Active Directory forest, to ensure that it can deliver messages to the correct recipient, it needs access to Active Directory information, which is provided by an instance of Active Directory Application Mode, ADAM, installed locally and synchronized with an instance from your intranet. This role can't be combined with others, as that would compromise security to some extent. Connectors are used to route messages to and from the intranet. Message routing with intranet or between trusted organizations is handled at the hub transport server. This role can be combined with others when required. The client access server role enables non-MAPI clients like POP, IMAP, and Outlook Anywhere to connect to Exchange. It functions like a front-end server does since 2003, without all the mailbox and routing elements to slow things down. The mailbox server is more like the traditional Exchange server that we saw in 2003, with all information stored and associated public and private stores. However, it doesn't handle non-MAPI client access or message routing, as these are handled by the other roles. By breaking a single server into distinct functional units, storage, routing, and access, the system works better, with the server able to focus on the given task. The Unified Messaging Server is all new and lets you combine email with both voicemail and fax services. When you install a Unified Messaging Server, you give your users a unified inbox. It links your PBX system with Exchange, handles voice calls, and provides answering services in addition to voicemail. It's important that you understand that these are server roles. You can combine these roles during installations so that a single physical server computer handles multiple roles. It's not necessary to purchase a separate physical computer to support each role, although it may be desirable in certain situations. Next, you'll look at how you might implement these roles to support your organization's messaging needs. We'll step through the roles one at a time. Let's think about a message that arrives at your organization. The Edge Transport Server sits isolated in the perimeter network, routing messages to and from the internet. Messages are filtered using agents, like the Connection Filtering Agent, which accepts or rejects SMTP connections from remote hosts based on IP addresses. Messages are also filtered based on sender, sender reputation, recipient address, and content. You can also combine third-party antivirus and anti-spam solutions at the Edge Transport Service to provide a clean messaging stream into your organization. Smaller organizations may not implement Edge service, preferring instead to use a hosted solution, like Microsoft Exchange Hosted Services. Once a message is deemed safe, the Edge passes it along to the Hub Transport Server. Connectors are defined on both the Edge Transport and the Hub Transport Servers to route messages from the perimeter network into your intranet. Connectors are defined in pairs. For example, a send connector at the Hub has a corresponding receive connector at the Edge. Communication between the Edge and Hub are secure and authenticated by default. Note that the EdgeSync subscription process can create all the necessary connectors for you. On arrival at the hub transport server, transport rules are applied to further filter the message, consisting of conditions, actions, and exceptions. These rules enable you to create an ethical firewall that ensures inappropriate content does not enter or leave your organization. You can also use transport rules to maintain regulatory conformance. Legal regulations require that you store messages for search and retrieval on demand by the appropriate government agency. You may also have your own internal organization regulations that require disclaimers to be attached to all messages or something similar. The transport agents provided in Exchange running on the Edge and Hub servers allow you to easily conform to these regulations. You need to install at least one Hub server in each Active Directory site that contains mailbox servers. The Hub transport server now passes the message to the appropriate mailbox server. If the user is currently connected to the mailbox server from an MAPI client such as Microsoft Outlook 2007, he or she is notified about the arrival of the new message. If the user is connected through an Exchange Active Sync, Outlook Web Access, or Outlook Anywhere, formerly known as RPC over HTTP, then the client access server is responsible for notifying the user. The message is retrieved by the remote client. Client access server can also ensure that remote users connect to a suitable client access server, one which is in the same site as their mailbox server. This can take the form of either redirection, that is telling the client which server to use, or proxying. You will also need one client access server in each Active Directory site that contains a mailbox server. Finally, the all-new Unified Messaging Server can link your PBX with your email. If a user is available, calls will be routed to telephones and faxes to fax machine. If the user is unavailable, an email message with the attached voice message will be placed in his or her mailbox. Outlook, OWA, and EAS clients provide in-message controls to hear and respond to these voice messages. Let's focus on the transport servers first of all. The Hub transport server and Edge transport servers are the bridgehead and gateway for Exchange 2007. Their primary mission is to send and receive mail. Many businesses will deploy a transport server into two groups, message hygiene, Edge transport server, and routing, Hub transport server. The Edge transport server's primary responsibility is to protect the Exchange infrastructure from incoming mail that contains spam or viruses. The Hub transport server will then categorize the clean mail and deliver it to the correct mailbox server. The storage impact on these servers fluctuates depending on the number of messages handled per second and the average size of those messages. Both the Exchange 2007 Edge transport server and Hub transport server store mail in an ESE database. The ESE database is randomly accessed and uses an 8 kilobyte page size. For reliability and in some cases for performance reasons, the database should be on separate disks from the transaction logs. All changes made to the database are first committed to the transaction log, which is a sequential write to the disk. The writes vary in size, from 512 bytes to log buffer size. Message tracking and protocol logging is a sequential write that, if enabled, causes a disk performance issue and consumes disk space to store the logs. When you keep a history of the protocol you choose to log, you can verify whether the protocol is performing its work as expected or is experiencing communications problems and identify attacks from the internet. On the Hub transport server, incoming mail from the internet is converted to MAPI prior to being delivered. This content conversion process occurs at the TMP folder to improve performance. The TMP folder should not be on the same LUN as the paging file or the operating system. If a process requests a page in memory and the system cannot find the page at the requested location, a page fault occurs. If the page is elsewhere in memory, the fault is a soft page fault. If the page must be retrieved from the disk, the fault is a hard page fault. Most processors can handle large numbers of soft page faults without consequence. However, hard page faults can cause significant delays. Continuous high rates of disk paging indicates a memory shortage. Customization of the transport server is done through code, known as SageInts, running in the Command Language Runtime, CLR, environment, and triggered by an event. Some agents log data, which will be a disk performance hit, and consume disk space to store logs. Let's look at sample configuration. The transport server should be based on 2x2 GHz dual-core CPUs with at least 2 GB of physical memory installed. Extensive testing on dual-core processors have shown that Exchange servers benefits from dual-core processor technology. The performance benefit for Exchange Server from dual-core technology depends on the specific processor used. The operating system, paging file, and temp folder should be placed on a single volume built on a two-disk RAID 1 array. The transaction log and the ESE database should be placed on another two-disk RAID 1 volume. The Exchange 2007 mailbox server role is a core server role upon which all server roles build. After you determine your mailbox profile, which includes user I/O per second and capacity, you can begin to plan your deployment. How many users you place on the Exchange server is usually based on a balance between preventing a hardware bottleneck, providing availability to backup and store that data within your service level agreement, SLA. There are three storage requirements that must be balanced to achieve a successful Exchange deployment. The first is the transactional I/O, or the performance measured in latency for each I/O to be satisfied by the storage. The second requirement is the backup and restore throughput, or how quickly your data can be moved to and from your backup medium. The third requirement is capacity, or ensuring that you have enough space in the chosen redundant array of independent disks, RAID configuration, for your production logical unit numbers, LUNs, and on the target backup medium. The mailbox server also stores mail in an ESE database. The ESE database is randomly accessed and uses an 8 kilobyte page size. Although I/O coalescing can result in larger I/Os, again, the database files and associated logs should be placed on a different physical disks to enhance both recoverability and performance. All changes made to the database are first committed to the transaction log, which is a sequential write to the disk. The writes vary in size from 512 bytes to the log buffer size. Content indexing is a random workload that should be placed on the same LUN as your database and will typically be around 5% of the database size. Because content indexing runs in the background, indexing messages as they arrive, the disk I/O impact is minimal. As with the transport server roles, insufficient physical memory can lead to excessive paging, which replaces a significant load on the disk subsystem. Most content conversion is done through the client access service and the hub transport service. Legacy web distributed authoring and versioning, WebDAV, content conversion for legacy Outlook web access clients occurs on the Exchange Mailbox server. When a client requests data that must be converted on a client access server, the data is accessed from the Exchange Mailbox server, converted in the Mailbox server temp folder, and sent to the client access server. To improve performance, the temp folder should not be on the same LUN as the page file and operating system. The Exchange 2007 information store requires periodic online maintenance to be run against each database. The tasks that affect disk I/O are the hard deletion of messages and mailboxes that are older than the configured retention policy, as well as online defragmentation of the database. Because backup will halt online defragmentation, care must be taken to give both backup and database maintenance exclusive windows of time to complete the task. Process of backing up data requires that data be read from databases and transaction log file volumes. This additional I/O can affect user response times and should be avoided during business hours. The process of backing up data requires that the data be read from the database and transaction log file volumes. This additional I/O can affect user response times and should be avoided during business hours. The process of soft recovery requires that the ESE play back all the transaction log files. This causes the I/O profile to be a sequential read stream. As a result, the recovery performance improves if the transaction log files are on a disk with fast sequential disk access. Let's look at sample configuration. The sample configuration is based on a 2000 user standalone deployment, providing throughput for 0.3 to 0.5 IOPS per user. We'll discuss how to determine your IOPS later in the session, and a 1 gigabyte mailbox quota. This also assumes 14 storage groups, with one database per storage group, and each database is about 200 gigabytes in size. To support this configuration, the mailbox server should be based on 4 times 2 gigahertz dual-core CPUs, with at least 12 gigabytes of physical memory installed, 12 gigabytes RAM is calculated by adding the base configuration of 2 gigabytes of memory to the additional memory needed to service 2,000 users at 5 megabytes extra memory per user. The operating system and paging file should be placed on a single volume built on a 2-disk RAID 1 array. The transaction logs should be placed on a RAID 1 volume, this time comprising 6 physical disks for reliability and performance. The logs are placed on a different volume from the database. The ESE databases should be placed on a RAID 10 array, comprising of a minimum of 20 disks. RAID 10 provides the same fault tolerance as RAID 1, but significantly higher I/O is achieved by striping the mirrored segments. Let's move on to the client access role. The client access server offloads many stateless tasks from the mailbox server, assuming the roles are installed on different physical servers, and provides a unified namespace, where your users need only to point to a single name, regardless of which mailbox server they're on. Internet protocols such as IMAP4, POP3, and HTTP, OWA, are serviced by the client access server. Outlook Anywhere, formerly known as RPC over HTTP, ActiveSync, AutoDiscover service, and web services are other examples of features serviced by the client access server. The client access server can be bottlenecked by CPU, memory, and network, yet it has a small disk I/O footprint. Simple mail transport protocol, SMTP, traffic, a potential disk I/O consideration in front-end servers running Exchange Server 2003 and Exchange 2000 Server, is now owned exclusively by the hub transport servers and the edge transport servers. Protocol logging causes a performance issue and consumes disk space. Consequently, only enable logging as and when required. Content conversion for all Exchange 2007 protocols occur on the client access server. Legacy WebDAV content conversion for legacy Outlook Web Access clients occur on the mailbox server. When a client requests data that must be converted on a client access server, the data is accessed from the mailbox server, converted in the mailbox server temp folder, and sent to the client access server. To improve performance, the temp folder should not be on the same LUN as a page file and operating system. Again, ensure sufficient memory is installed to avoid paging. Let's take a quick look at a sample configuration. The client access should be based on 2x2 GHz dual-core CPUs with at least 2 GB of physical memory installed. The operating system page file, temp folder, and transaction logs can all be placed on a single volume built on a 2-disk RAID 1 array. Now let's talk about the unified messaging server role for a moment. Call handling is a term that is used to describe how incoming calls are answered and handled by a computer that's running the Exchange 2007 unified messaging role. The types of incoming calls that are handled are voice calls, fax calls, Outlook voice access, the play on phone feature, and UM auto attendance. Voice call handling is used when a user leaves a voice message for a subscriber on the Exchange Unified Messaging System. Incoming voice calls are created as a MIME messages on the UM server and then submitted using SMTP to the Exchange Hub Transport server. Fax call handling is used when an internal or external user sends a fax message to the UM-enabled recipient on the Exchange Unified Messaging System. Incoming fax calls are created as a MIME messages and are handled in the same way as voice calls. Unified messaging servers also process and route incoming calls that are received by Outlook Voice Access users. When a UM-enabled user or subscriber dials a subscriber access number that is set up on a UM dial plan to access his or her Exchange 2007 mailbox, he or she is presented with a welcome message and a series of telephone user interfaces to UI voice prompts. The voice menu system that is presented to the user is called Outlook Voice Access. These voice prompts help the user navigate and interact with the unified messaging system by using touch tone or speech inputs. Outlook Voice Access is a feature that enables a UM-enabled user to access his or her Exchange 2007 mailbox by using a telephone. To enable the Play on Phone feature for UM-enabled users, the UM server must first answer and correctly route a call when it's placed by a user who is using Exchange 2007 Outlook Web Access or Microsoft Office Outlook 2007. This feature lets a UM-enabled user listen to a voice message by using a telephone instead of playing it over computer speakers or headphones. To enable UM auto-attendant feature found in Exchange 2007 Unified Messaging, UM servers must correctly answer and then route incoming calls that are received from internal and external anonymous or authenticated users. To enable a UM auto-attendant to answer incoming calls, you must first enable and configure a UM auto-attendant. A UM auto-attendant is a set of voice prompts that callers hear instead of human operator when they place a call to an organization that has the Exchange 2007 Unified Messaging. A UM auto-attendant helps callers navigate the organization's menu system by using the DTMF or touch phone inputs or voice activated inputs that use speech recognition so that they can locate a user or caller in an organization, then place the call. Call handling generates a minimal disk I/O load. As with the transport servers, protocol logging is a sequential write that can cause a performance issue and consume disk space. Only enable protocol logging when and where necessary. As always, ensure there's plenty of physical memory installed to avoid paging. We'll look at another sample configuration. Like the client access server role, the unified messaging server should be placed on 2x2 GHz dual core CPUs with at least 2 GB of physical memory installed. The operating system, paging file, tempfold, and transaction loss can all be placed on a single volume built on a 2-disk RAID 1 array. Let's return to the agenda. In this third section, we're going to take a look at storage design issues. We'll consider mailbox size, quota limits, storage types, and performance considerations. Let's start with the basics. Before you can select a storage solution for your Exchange organization, you must first understand the implications of using various storage solutions. Network attached storage, NAS, locally attached storage, shared storage, iSCSI, storage area networks, SAN, and direct attached storage, DAS, all have different features, benefits, and requirements. In addition, not all are supported in given configurations. For example, if you intend using single copy cluster, you must plan to implement shared storage, or some storage architecture that supports shared nothing access. Storage for CCR configuration does not need to be shared between servers that make up the cluster, because the storage is not shared between nodes in the cluster. Hardware setup is easier. You can select between DAS, SAN, iSCSI, or other supported storage. When planning storage, consider disaster recovery scenarios. It's important that you plan for recovering from disaster as quickly as the situation requires. You must ensure that you are able to utilize the fast recover technologies built into Exchange 2007. These include database portability that allows you to mount a database on any server in your organization, LCR and CCR, which provides duplicates of an entire storage group, and VSS, which, in Exchange 2007, you can restore VSS backups to alternative locations. Because CCR creates a second copy of databases on a passive node, the passive node can be used to offload the effect of doing regular backups. For example, by doing backups on the passive node, the backup window can be extended and the I/O load is no longer on the active node. You need to consider all of this when planning your storage. Let's have a look at capacity planning now. Users may store an excessive amount of email, voicemail, and fax messages, along with attached files. If users in your organization store a large amount of data in their mailboxes, you may need to limit the amount of storage space allocated to each user to reduce the storage demands on your Exchange 2007 computers, or make additional storage available. In many cases, large mailbox stores lead to long backup and restore times, which affect the availability and reliability of your Exchange environment. Based on this, it is recommended that you control the size of users' mailboxes to avoid a situation in which you run out of storage space on your Exchange computers. When you first install Microsoft Exchange Server, users have unlimited mailbox quotas by default. This means that your users could possibly fill up the disk drives on the Exchange Server. However, you can prevent this from happening by enabling and configuring storage quotas on your users' mailboxes. After you have configured storage quotas, if a storage limit is exceeded, the mailbox-enabled user is warned or prohibited from sending or receiving email. You can use the default storage limits, or you can set your own storage limits to control the amount of data that can be stored on a user's mailbox. If you're implementing unified messaging, keep in mind that implementing mailbox quotas can impact a user's ability to receive voice and fax messages. Outlook 2003 and later versions support online and cached modes of operation. Choosing between the two can affect storage capacity. In cached mode, the Outlook client is responsible for searches and sorts, while in online mode, it's the responsibility of the server. The initial index creation can be expensive in terms of storage consumption. In Exchange 2007, a number of changes have been made to the storage architecture, including a reduction in the size of transaction log files from 5 megabytes to 1 megabyte. This is primarily to support CCR log shipping requirements. In addition, because the naming convention for logs has also changed, an Exchange server can have many more log files in the transaction logs folder. When an administrator performs a backup operation, the log files are removed at the end of the backup operation. If you do not perform regular and appropriate backup operations, log file disk space consumption will increase. As part of your planning process, configure the frequency and the type of backup operations that impact on transaction log size. Let's take a look at some typical storage configurations. Exchange Server 2007 gives far more flexibility when selecting a storage architecture, because neither LCR nor CCR requires shared storage. You can choose between direct attached storage, storage area network devices, and iSCSI solutions. DAS is storage that is directly connected to a server by connectivity media such as parallel SCSI cables. This direct connection provides fast access to the data, however, storage is only accessible from that server. DAS includes the internally attached local disk drives or externally attached RAID, redundant array of independent disks. Although fiber channel can be used for direct attached storage, it is more commonly used in storage area networks. This is an effective solution for Exchange servers in the smaller Exchange organizations. Benefits of DAS are that it's relatively inexpensive and it provides a high performance when combined with a RAID controller on a PCI bus or Ultra 3 SCSI. However, DAS doesn't scale well and has higher management costs. Networked storage solutions have enabled organizations to more effectively share, consolidate, and manage resources that were possible with direct attached storage, DAS. The shift from server-centric storage to network storage has been dependent on the development of technologies that can transfer data to and from the storage as fast as, or faster, than direct attached technologies, while also overcoming the limitations inherent with parallel SCSI, the dominant interconnect for DAS. The Storage Area Network, SAN, is a specialized network that provides access to high-performance and highly available storage subsystems using block storage protocols. The SAN is made up of specific devices such as host bus adapters, HBAs, in the host servers. Switches that help route storage traffic and disk storage subsystems. The main characteristic of SAN is that the storage subsystems are generally available to multiple hosts at the same time, which makes them scalable and flexible. Benefits of SAN are that it's scalable. Storage can be easily added, it's good for clustering solutions, and it provides high throughput for large infrastructure. However, it's relatively expensive and quite complex, requiring specialized knowledge to configure correctly. iSCSI is a protocol that enables transport to block data over IP networks, without the need for specialized network infrastructure, such as fiber channel. Both SAN and iSCSI support shared access and, therefore, can be used to implement SCC clustering, as discussed earlier in the session. iSCSI use company IP networks to transfer block-level data between computer systems and storage devices. Unlike other network storage, iSCSI uses the existing network infrastructure, network adapters, network cabling, hubs, switches, routers, and supporting software. iSCSI is based on the serial SCSI standard and can operate over existing Category 5 or higher copper Ethernet cable or fiber optic wiring. iSCSI enables SANs by connecting storage to existing company network infrastructure. Small and mid-sized organizations, previously priced out of the fiber channel solution, can now afford SAN technologies. iSCSI or SAN over IP makes the following SAN solutions widely available. Pool storage. Multiple computer systems can access shared storage resources, enabling highly effective storage use. Maximum scalability and equipment consolidation. Highly available storage with multiple connectors and the appropriate software supporting multiple I/O paths between the SAN and servers. Multiple failover paths are supported if some aspect of the hardware fails. Data redundancy. Better data protection is achieved through the disk mirroring to a second storage box for fault tolerance and replication to a remote device for disaster recovery. iSCSI proves that a more cost-effective alternative to SANs, a more scalable architecture than DAS, data can be transmitted over existing networks, although the devices appear to be connected directly to the servers. Before we move on to discuss iSCSI details, it's worth mentioning the network-attached storage is no longer supported in Exchange Server 2007. Instead, Exchange supports iSCSI. Since iSCSI operates in the Internet environment, security is critically important. The IP protocol itself does not authenticate legitimacy of the data source, the sender, and does not protect the transferred data, iSCSI, therefore requires strict measures to ensure the security across IP networks. The iSCSI protocol specifies the uses of IPsec to ensure that the communicating endpoints, the initiator and target, are authentic, that the transferred data has been secured through encryption and is thus kept confidential, that data integrity is maintained without modification by a third party, and that data is not processed more than once, even if it has been received multiple times. iSCSI also requires that CHAP be implemented to further authenticate end-node identities. Other optional authentication protocols include Kerberos, which is a highly scalable option. Even though the standard requires that these protocols be implemented, there is no such requirement to use them in an iSCSI network. Before implementing iSCSI, a network administrator should review the security measures to make sure that they are appropriate for the intended use and configuration of the iSCSI storage network. The amount of time it takes to queue, transfer, and process data across the network is referred to as latency. One of the drawbacks of transmitting SCSI commands across a TCP/IP network is that latency is higher than it is on a fiber channel network, in part because of the overhead associated with TCP/IP protocols. Additionally, many currently deployed Ethernet switches were not designed with the low latency specification associated with fiber channel. Although Ethernet cabling is capable of higher speeds, the actual speed of transmission may be lower than expected, particularly during periods of network congestion. One possible solution is to implement a separate gigabit network for your iSCSI network. Next, we'll examine RAID implementations. When planning disk fault tolerance, it's important to try to balance performance with capacity requirements. RAID 5 proves the best capacity efficiency, however, due to poor performance, the extra space is not often utilized. In a failover, there is upward to a 30% hit on read performance until the failed disk is replaced. This rises to over 70% when the RAID is being rebuilt after a failed disk has been replaced. In addition, it's worth remembering that RAID 5 offered slip-and-dip protection. A single disk failure is tolerated before the data loss occurs. RAID 6 provides increased data protection over RAID 5, but the cost of worse performance with less capacity efficiency. RAID 10 has the best reliability, with its ability to lose more than one disk in a RAID group at any one time before the data loss occurs. In addition, there's a light performance hit during a failed disk scenario. Read performance is slightly degraded, also there's only a slight performance hit during RAID rebuild after the failed disks have been replaced. For these reasons, RAID 10 is a good choice. Let's have a look at the impact of a drive failure in RAID 5, just to highlight the performance problem. Using Performance Monitor, you can easily view the effect of a drive rebuild following disk failure, in this case on a RAID 5 configured volume. When disk reads and writes peak, this is at the expense of disk transfers, which degrade significantly during the rebuild operation, This may be acceptable to some customers, but not to others. Now some tips on improving throughput. The Disk Quiet utility provides administrators with the ability to track aligned disks. When a disk has been correctly aligned, it can have a significant effect on storage performance, perhaps as much as 20%. Before we look at this in detail, let's just define some basic terms. A partition is an area, a container, that is created on a disk. The partition is then formatted and available for use. And although multiple partitions can be created on a physical disk, this offers no performance benefit and should be avoided. A physical disk comprises of tracks, each consisting of multiple sectors. A sector being the smallest accessible unit on the disk, sectors are combined in allocation units. The default allocation unit size in Windows is 4096 bytes, or 8 sectors. Misalignment can occur because a master boot record, which is 63 sectors in size, and located at the beginning of all disks, leaves a single sector remaining from the first 64 sectors on the disk. This causes the partition to start on the 64th sector. Consequently, every 8th read or write operation will cross a boundary on the disk. This causes two I/O operations instead of just one. By starting the partition at the 65th sector on the disk, these dual I/O operations can be avoided, improving disk performance. The vendor of the disk will have recommendations as to where the partition should start, but opt for a 64 sector offset. This doesn't really matter where it starts as long as it's 4096 byte boundary from the start of the disk. Once you've aligned the disk, you can format it and place a storage group on it. When you format the disk to optimize cache, ensure that you configure the correct allocation unit size. Let's have a look at how to select the correct allocation unit size. Exchange Server accesses the database files in a 4096 byte read and write operations. This is also the default disk allocation unit size. This is ideal in most situations. What this means is that when you have aligned your disk to a 4K boundary, you have a 4K allocation unit. You have the most efficient structure on the disk. It's worth noting that if you increase the allocation unit size, perhaps to 64K, still a multiple of 4K, this can have an advantageous effect when performing streaming backup operations. In this demo, we'll put what we've just learned into practice. We'll use disk part to configure alignment on a disk, and then format the disk, select from the appropriate allocation unit size, and finally, move a storage group onto the new volume. In this demonstration, we will run through the correct procedure for moving a storage group onto a newly installed disk. First, we will configure disk alignment as per the storage manufacturer's recommendation. Let's open a command prompt. We'll use the disk part program, although on earlier versions of Exchange, you'd have been using the tool called disk par, a Windows resource kit utility. In Windows Server 2003, disk part provides the necessary alignment tool. Let's list the installed disks. It's a blank disk 2 that we want, and remember, if your disk was not already blank, you would need to back up the disk first, as this process removes all the data from it. Use the select disk command to change the focus on the second disk. Now we'll create a new partition using the create partition command. We'll define the type as primary, and use the align equals 64 command to define the alignment. Next, we assign a drive letter, or mount point. We'll assign drive letter E with the assign letter command. Now we just need to format the partition. Let's exit this part and close the command prompt window. Next, we open up the computer management and navigate to the disk management folder. The new disk is listed as drive E, the letter we assigned, but has no file system. If we right-click the drive and then click format, we can specify the necessary information. Let's ensure that we give the volume a sensible name, First Storage Group. Now let's set the allocation unit size of 4096 bytes. Remember, use this value, which is default, unless your vendor advises otherwise. We'll format the disk, which won't take long, as this is a small virtual drive. Finally, when the disk activity has ceased, we can close the computer management window. Next, we need to move the storage group databases. We can move the storage group from the shell or using the console. We'll use the console today. Navigate to the Server Configuration Work Center and then use the Manage Mailbox Role link in the Action panel to jump to the storage groups. Again, using the Action Pane link, we start the Move Storage Group wizard. First, we specify where we want to put the system files and transaction logs for the group. We'll leave the logs where they are and move only the system files. Browse to the new volume and create a new folder there called First Storage Group System Files. Then move the files across. Now let's also move the existing database files. Select the mailbox database and use the Action Pane link to move it. We need to specify a path. We'll put the existing database files into the same folder that we created to host the storage group system files. Remember that log files are defined at the storage group level, so we are not asked for a location for log files when we move the database. It will take a moment to move the content of the database across, during which time the database will be unavailable. The console updates with a new path in the results pane when the move is completed. Now we'll close the console. Let's verify that the move was successful by using the shell to query for storage group system folder path value. Open the shell, enter the get storage group, first storage group, pipe, select object system folder path command. If it returns the expected value, the move was successful. Let's close the shell and return to the presentation. Let's return to the agenda for a moment. In this section, we'll take a look at the backup operations. We'll touch on LCR and CCR and finish the section with a demo on establishing LCR. You can either use LCR or CCR to provide your first line of defense. Both LCR and CCR guard against data loss resulting from media failure. However, neither provide a suitable alternative to backup. For example, in the event of something being deleted or damaged at the database level, that deletion or damage will be copied to the replica. Therefore, it's important to plan and implement proper backup routines. Using the primary database, you have the option to perform legacy streaming backups to disk or tape. You can also perform VSS snapshots to disk or tape and create a VSS clone. Using the replicated database, you can also perform VSS snapshots to disk or tape. With CCR, you can also choose to offload backup I/O to passive LAN. Because Exchange Server can support very large databases, you need to consider your daily backup regime carefully. Large quantities of data being streamed to tape from a primary database on a daily basis will severely hamper operations and impact performance. Consider using VSS to backup the replica database when you have implemented CCR or LCR. This avoids affecting the production run. Also, instead of performing daily full backups, consider weekly full and daily incremental backups. Also, instead of performing daily full backups, consider weekly full and daily incremental backups. Think about the numbers. A 2,000 user database, each with a 2 GB mailbox, contains 4 TB of data. At 75 GB per hour, this will take 23 hours to backup. With weekly full backups supplemented with daily incremental backups, that could drop significantly, perhaps to a few hours. It's also worth staggering the databases for the full backup, so that each night you perform 2 full backups and 12 incremental backups for your 14 database server. In this demonstration, we'll set up and test local continuous replication. Let's take a look at how quickly and easily you can enable local continuous replication. We'll perform this task from the console. Navigate to the Server Configuration Work Center and use the Manage Mailbox role in the action to jump to the right place. Click the link in the Action pane to enable local continuous backup. We need to specify a path for the system files first. Then we need to specify a path for the system files. Finally, we need to define the location for the existing databases within the storage group. Remember that the LCR operates at the storage group level by using log shipping. Microsoft recommends that you only define one database per storage group. So, in essence, LCR operates at the database level. Then we complete the process. To verify, we can use Windows Explorer to check for the presence of the database and log files. They are all present, so it appears to have been successful. Let's return to the presentation. In this last section, we'll talk about monitoring and testing Exchange Server storage. We'll talk about jet stress and review how to determine your IOPS. We'll also be looking at what counters to watch for in Performance Monitor. Before performing a demo on stress testing Exchange, let's start with a summary of performance monitoring. Before you start measuring anything, it's important to understand what it is that you're looking to achieve. When you collect statistics, unless you know how to interpret them and understand what they're telling you, you won't have learned much about the system. Determine what numbers you're hoping to achieve in terms of, say, disk latency, what represents a good value, what's a bad value. What value would you want to get? When you have all the pieces of this puzzle, you can start making judgments about statistics you can collect. Try to keep the test environment as close to the real world as you can. Build test servers with the same hardware and software configuration as production systems, and then impose a similar load onto the test servers. Otherwise, the test is, to a large extent, invalidated. Using large databases introduces additional load onto the system. So it's important to work with representatively sized databases. It's all too easy in a test system to measure things on a freshly commissioned, empty, and therefore unrepresentative server. During the design phase, you need to calculate what acceptable throughput is and determine, during the test phase, whether the storage you plan to implement is capable of meeting your throughput targets. If a storage solution is capable of delivering better throughput, how much headroom do you have for a future expansion? Determine the maximum throughput that can be achieved with the planned storage infrastructure. During the session, we have mentioned IOPS. Calculating your disk I/O requirements ultimately allows you to optimize your disk subsystem to best support your users. Your goal is to provide enough disk I/O performance, measured by the number of I/O operations per second, or IOPS, that can be performed, with acceptable latency that allows for efficient exchange functionality. Calculating the IOPS per mailbox is a convenient way to measure the profile for a given server based on random database read-write I/O. The transaction log I/O is not factored into this equation. The higher the IOPS per mailbox, the more aggressive the mailbox profile is in terms of disk usage. There are two approaches to calculating your disk I/O requirements. Determine user needs based on theoretical data, or calculate user activity by using Performance Console. Regardless of your approach, you should plan and calculate based on peak usage periods. In many companies, this occurs at the beginning of business hours as people arrive at work and check their email. If you don't have Exchange already, you can determine the IOPS by using the information in the Microsoft Exchange Optimizing Storage White Paper, available from the Exchange website. I'll give you that URL later. Write usage may be a result of users with a 50 megabyte mailbox, sending and receiving around 70 emails a day. This provides an IOPS of 0.5. At the other end of the spectrum, a user with a 500 megabyte mailbox sending and receiving over 200 emails per day would result in a user IOPS of 1.5. You can now multiply the IOPS per user by the number of light and heavy users of email on a particular database and come up with the IOPS per database. For example, with 2,000 average users, the IOPS per database volume would be 1,500. but each profile represents total I/O to the JET database and does not include I/O related to transaction log file activity. In order to accurately calculate your disk subsystem load, you must split this database I/O into read and write I/O, because write operations are more I/O intensive than reads. Using a conservative ratio of 2 reads for every write, you would plan for 1,000 read I/O and 500 write I/O requests per second for your database volume. Every write request is first written to the transaction log file and then written to the database. Approximately 10% of the total 1,500 IOPS seen on the database volume will be seen on the transaction log value. 10% of 1,500 is 150 IOPS. 500 write IO requests will be written to the database. When you increase the number of users with the similar profiles on an Exchange server, more users must compete with the database cache, causing an increase in database transfers. For example, 1,000 mailboxes at 1.0 IOPS produces 1,000 IOPS. On the database logical unit number, LUN, if you double the number of users with the same profile to 2,000, then the formula is 1.0 IOPS times 2,000 mailboxes times 1.25 equals 2,500 IOPS. This effect is lessened by using Exchange 2007, as the cache can be significantly larger with the Exchange 2003, so you can use these figures shown here. But keep in mind that IOPS is reduced by about 70% in Exchange 2007. So going back in our example, the expected IOPS for a single database server with 2,000 average users on Exchange 2003 would be 1,500, while the Exchange 2007 you could expect a value around 600. Let's discuss the JET stress tool. JET stress is an Exchange tool that allows administrators to test the performance and stability of the disk subsystem prior to introducing the server into production environment. Specifically, JET stress tests disk performance by simulating the Exchange disk I/O load. To verify that your disk subsystem meets or exceeds your performance criteria, you can use System Monitor, Event Viewer, and ESC Util in conjunction with JET stress. With JET stress, you can perform two types of tests. The JET stress disk performance test runs for 2 hours and allows you to verify the performance and sizing of your storage solution. The JET stress disk subsystem test runs for 24 hours and enables you to test the storage reliability over a significant amount of time. Running both tests is the best way to verify the integrity and performance of your disk subsystem. After successfully completing the JET stress disk performance test and JET stress disk subsystem stress test in a non-production environment, you can move to the next stage in your Exchange deployment process. By running JET stress, you will have ensured that your Exchange disk subsystem is adequately sized in terms of performance criteria you establish for the user count and user profiles you established. Use monitoring to ensure that you catch indications of impending hardware failures. For example, the event log may well contain errors that indicate an imminent disk failure. These might include 1018 JET error read verify failure events. This error is caused by a problem in the disk subsystem. The problem in the disk subsystem may be caused by defective disk drives, by outdated or incompatible disk drive firmware, or by outdated or incompatible controller firmware. Sometimes too much heat around the disk subsystem components may cause this error. When you attempt to perform an online backup that subsequently fails, you may notice events of 477 and 474 in the event log. Again, these errors indicate a problem in the disk subsystem. Event 477 also indicates a potential issue with the storage subsystem. If you get any of these events in your event logs, you should investigate the disk subsystem for the problems before they result in a database corruption and interruption of service to users. Regular monitoring will also enable you to catch storage performance issues before clients are affected. And remember, storage capacity planning is not enough by itself. Exchange I/O characteristics can change over time. For example, the usage profile may change, mailbox sizes will increase over time, and third-party applications may be introduced. All this means that you have to be proactive in your monitoring. Collect the same statistics under the same conditions and compare to your baseline on a regular basis. Only then can you catch changes in the I/O characteristics. Let's quickly run through some tools available to help you perform this monitoring. Several tools can assist you with the day-to-day monitoring of Exchange Server. Network Monitor allows you to capture network packets and examine their contents. It's most useful in troubleshooting situations when you need to determine why something is not functioning as it should. For example, you can monitor communications between the client access server and the mailbox server when troubleshooting OWA. You can start Exchange Server Performance Monitor, logs and alerts from the Toolbox Work Center in the Exchange Management Console. The default is a graphical display of real-time statistics, but because this is your Windows System Monitor, you can change the objects and counters to suit to your needs. In addition, you can use the Performance Logs and Alerts Monitor to gather statistics about your server. With the Event Viewer, Exchange Server reports problems and errors to the Windows Event Log. You should check both the system and application logs regularly for any important events. The Microsoft Operations Manager MOM 2005 Exchange Management Pack allows you to extend your Exchange Server monitoring capabilities. MOM 2005 provides far more than just event collection. It can determine those events that are important to the Exchange Server environment and bring them to your attention. MOM 2005 detects events that are likely to result in service failure or interruption and sends you an alert so you can take action. You can also use MOM 2005 to monitor server health, server availability, server usage, server resources including mailbox store sizes, available disk space, and the number of mailboxes on each server, and server network traffic. There are a few more monitoring tools. Not strictly a tool, but the white paper on optimizing Exchange 2003 storage will prove invaluable. Remember to use the figures and adjust the Exchange 2007 with its 70% reduction in IOPS. The Exchange Performance Troubleshooting Analyzer provides PerformOM data collection reporting on queue thresholds. Data on network thresholds, LDAP latency checks, and reporting RPC requests, information about memory changes and improved reporting features. It collates and presents the information in a useful form for the administrator, helping identify bottlenecks and other areas of concern. Additionally, in Exchange Server 2007, you can analyze your Exchange Server for potential problems that arise from poor configurations by using the Exchange Server Best Practice Analyzer tool. This tool will check for health, connectivity, and, optionally, the performance of the whole organization or one or more individual servers. You can start the tool from the Toolbox Work Center in the Exchange Management Console. The Exchange Server Best Practice Analyzer tool produces detailed reports that highlight configuration problems. Next, information on what counters should look like. On your server computer, RPC average latency should be around 50 ms, and not exceed a maximum of 100 ms. The disk latency should average 20 ms, with a maximum of 40 ms. Log writes should be less than 10 ms. Database reads should be less than 20 ms, as should database writes, and finally, database page faults should be less than 1. Let's take a look at our last demonstration. In this demo, we'll put our Exchange Server under some load and use Performance Monitor to view the results of the system. During this demonstration, we're going to load Performance Monitor and then generate some messaging traffic to impose the load on the system. Let's start by opening up the Exchange Management Console, then switch to the Tools folder and double-click Performance Monitor. We can see that activity is minimal. These counters are representative of general server throughput. We could add more specific counters if we felt that there was a particular problem that needed investigating. However, for now, this will just show the activity generated by the script we're going to run. Let's just switch to the desktop. Open up the scripts folder. In our example, we have a script that will send Spencer Lowe 1,000 text messages. That will place a load on the system, as both the hub, transport, and mailbox server roles perform the respective functions. Simply double-click the file and acknowledge the message. Now, we can see there's quite a bit of activity going on here. You can see that the average RPC latency is hovering around 9 to 10. In addition, the local delivery rate rises and falls as messages are delivered to the store. Processor time is up around 65%, which means that the server is working reasonably hard, but is well within the limits. Memory pages per second are up too, which can indicate a memory problem. we really wanted to stress the system, we could run another file to deliver more messages. If we do this, we can see that the counters we mentioned are moving up in an upward direction because of the additional load. While this test hasn't been especially scientific, it does show how easily you can use the built-in tools to measure your system performance. Generally, you should record this information to a log rather than using live chart view as we have in this example. Let's return to the presentation to run through a short session summary. During today's session, we started with an overview of the benefits of the 64-bit architecture of Exchange Server 2007. We learned that the extra memory this gives Exchange allows the server to allocate more memory to cache, resulting in significantly reduced IOPS. We saw that this leads to improvements in throughput, enabling large, low-cost mailboxes. We discussed the features and benefits of LCR and CCR and contrasted CCR with older clustering technologies. We identified the improvements to reliability that Exchange Server 2000 provides, including both LCR and CCR, and contrasted these technologies with those available in Exchange 2003. In the second part of this session, we looked at the server roles and how each role impacts storage. During that discussion, we identified the recommended configurations for each server role in terms of processor, memory, and storage. In the third part of the session, we talked about the design issues relating to storage and looked at three storage architectures and their respective features and benefits: direct attached storage, storage area network, and iSCSI. We touched on disk alignment, and during a demonstration we saw how to create and correctly align disk support Exchange storage groups. We talked about backup considerations, followed by a demo on configuring local continuous replication. Finally, we talked about performance monitoring and how to calculate your throughputs, how to measure the throughput and responsiveness of your server, and how to identify key problem areas in your storage architecture, before finishing with a demo on the performance monitor on a system under stress. For the most comprehensive technical information on Microsoft products, visit the TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/TechNet. You can also visit www.microsoft.com/TechNet/ITProExc107 for more information on books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that relate directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, MOC, which includes e-learning, Microsoft Pressbooks, workshops, clinic, and Microsoft Skills Assessment, MOC, is offered in an instructor-led environment and offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals in supporting and implementing solutions using the Microsoft products and technologies. The course that best supports this session is Getting Started with Microsoft Exchange Server 2007 Clinic, which is available now. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There's also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills in implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short, 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The skills assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which includes links to Microsoft official curriculum, specific TechNet articles, Microsoft Pressbooks, and other Microsoft learning content. There's also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including Security and Patch Management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and all VisualStudio.net. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, a number of certification programs are available. In a highly competitive IT job market, how can you differentiate yourself from the next candidate? The Microsoft Certification Program provides that edge. Earning a specific accreditation provides objective validation of the availability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft Certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. There are a number of accreditations available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional, MCP. You can choose to go on to become a fully certified systems administrator, MCSA, or a system engineer, MCSE, or a desktop specialist, MCDST. Away from the infrastructure side, the MCDBA certifications cover Cisco server products. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which I'm sure you'll find interesting to hear about.
TechNet Plus subscription introduces its newest offering, TechNet Plus Direct. With TechNet Plus Direct, subscribers get all of the benefits of TechNet Plus for 30% less. Subscribers receive fast, easy access to the tools and information they need to get the most out of Microsoft solutions. A subscription provides IT professionals with immediate online access to all the essential technical resources they need to resolve technical issues faster, get hands-on experience with the latest Microsoft technologies, and build technical skills. Subscribers now get immediate access to all their subscription features in one convenient location, our new online benefits portal. Subscribers get access through subscriber download to Microsoft full version software for evaluation and beta releases without time or feature limits. No more waiting for media shipments. This includes Microsoft Server, Client, and Application Software titles. With full version software, subscribers can make informed decisions about new technologies and deployments at their own pace. For the toughest technical questions, a TechNet Plus subscription also comes with two complimentary professional support incidents. Subscribers can talk to a Microsoft support professional to quickly resolve their mission-critical technical issues fast. TechNet Plus also provides access to over 100 managed newsgroups. Subscribers can exchange ideas with other professionals and get expert answers to their technical questions within the next business day, guaranteed. In addition, subscribers can also chat with a Microsoft Search Assistant online for help finding the technical resources they need or for assistance with non-technical questions. Subscribers also get access to technical information and tools, including the TechNet Plus library containing the knowledge base, security updates, service packs, resource kits, and more. TechNet Plus offers proven value that far exceeds its cost. The two complimentary professional support incidents alone more than offset the cost of a TechNet Plus subscription. Add to that the evaluation and beta software and other technical resources, and TechNet Plus clearly boosts productivity. Every IT professional on the team needs one. TechNet Plus is available exclusively online without media shipments. For more information, please visit technet.microsoft.com/subscriptions. There are a number of free community resources available on TechNet. You can attend a regular chat with members of the product groups or technology specialists from Microsoft, or you can attend a webcast where you can see sessions like the one you've just watched, but presented live and with the ability to ask questions as you go. You can also read or post questions in public news groups. The newsgroup page lists the available groups and provides an interface from which you can read and post messages. TechNet Plus subscribers can use these groups to post questions and, through their subscription ID, are guaranteed a response from Microsoft support professionals and IT experts by the next business day. The main community site provides a comprehensive list of resources available, more than we can cover on this slide, and the page has some dynamic features with continually updated content. The events page provides dates and details about attending a live TechNet event. These events take place around the world and provide the opportunity for you to talk to Microsoft specialists face-to-face. And finally, the TechNet columns provide a variety of topics written by industry authors. And with that, thank you for taking the time to listen to this TechNet session.